is Spectra.
Alternative Medicine. Homeopathy. Secret Society. Hypnosis. The Paranormal. Alternative Energy. UFO. Abduction. The Weird. The Wild. And the Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan, here with my co-host, Tom Theopanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm good. Well, today we have a great, great guest. His name is Dr. George Steinfeld. He's a PhD, and he has been practicing psychology in Connecticut for over 40 years. He is highly trained in human behavior and is an approved clinical supervisor in marriage and family therapy. Dr. Steinfeld takes a holistic approach in helping and relieving suffering in the quickest and most effective way possible. He has worked in mental hospitals, child guidance clinics, prisons with addicted inmates, and has his own private practice. Dr. Steinfeld has over 40 professional publication and has given many local, state, and national presentations. Welcome, George.
Oh, welcome. Thank you.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Okay, Scott.
Well, so we're going to have plenty of questions for you today.
Okay. I hope I can answer them in some appropriate and rational manner. I'll do my best.
Okay. Maybe I'll let Scott start off.
Sure. I want to know about his evolution in the practice. If there's been some multiple changes through his life and the way he's approached clinical psychology and working with patients.
Okay. I'd be happy to address that. If you would have told me that I would be doing what I'm doing now with clients, I do not call them patients, I call them clients.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is they hire me to perform a service, and if I don't do it, they can fire me. So that's I used to call people patients, I don't do that anymore.
Right.
Okay, so I started out at the Yeshiva University for my clinical training, and then I interned at Fairfield Hills Hospital. And I like to tell the story of what happened at Fairfield Hills Hospital because it was a turning point in my life.
Okay.
When I came to Fairfield Hills Hospital in Connecticut in September of 1964, my first patient was a very disturbed, cool then schizophrenic girl who, would see hallucinations and she had all sorts of delusions, etc. I worked with her for 5 years, three times a week. At the end of the 5 years, she made absolutely no progress. I was being supervised by the biggest supervisors in the field at that time. I was trained in analytic psychotherapy, and my supervisors really had no answers for how to help this young 17-year-old girl. So I started to question whether or not it was me or it was the model that I was applying to try to understand and help this very young and disturbed young lady. Joan, her name was. Joanne.
Okay.
So here I am, three times a week, sitting with this person, trying to really understand, and I tried everything that I knew at that time, and nothing seemed to help her overcome her delusions and hallucinations. And my supervisors, all they could say to me was, she's a very disturbed person, it takes a long time, all of what we called, or I subsequently came to call, bullshit. This was the party line. Okay, because our field in 1964 had nothing to offer other than sitting and listening and interpreting things.
So that's what you say when you can't actually help anyone. When you can't help someone, you just say, well, they're very disturbed, it takes a long
time. That's one of the bullshit stories in our field, okay? So then what happened is I said, wait a second, there must be another way that I had not been exposed to during my training. So I picked up four books. One was called The Strategies of Psychotherapy by Jay Haley, a very famous family therapist, brilliant guy. Mm-hmm. I picked up the book called Asylums by a guy named Goffman, who talked about total institutions. I'll get to that in a few minutes. It was suggested to me that I read that book when I was in graduate school by my social psychologist, and I started to read it. I said, this has nothing to do with me. A few years later, I'm devouring this book. The other book I read was Reality Therapy by Glasser, and the probably one of the most biggest influences on my life was a book by Thomas Szasz at Syracuse University, psychiatrist, who wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, and where he talks about diagnosis being really a political story that we tell, has nothing to do with what's going on inside the person. When I started to read these things and realized there were other ways, I started to apply them to the, I call them patients at that time, to the people I was working with in the back wards of the mental hospital. And so that was, I was there from 64 to the end of 69, 1970. In about 1968, we started to question all of the practices at the hospital. We felt that patients weren't being treated with the dignity and humanity that we felt was the essence of mental health. And so we embarked on a two-year battle with the administration for patients' rights. You know, back in the 60s, everything mm-hmm. about rights was going on at that time. And so we felt that the patients weren't represented and had no power. And okay. So we said, we need to do something about that. Of course, that led to a big battle with the administration. The American Civil Liberties Union came in. We hit the newspapers. We were not prepared for this because we weren't interested in any political thing. We felt that patients weren't being treated right. And so it led to a big investigation, a two-year investigation, supported by the Connecticut Psychologist for Social Action. No one else supported the three of us. We are three guys that were fighting this fight. And we were ostracized by the community of other psychologists. The American Psychological Association didn't help us. The Connecticut Psychological Association didn't help us. The only people that supported our work was a local mental health association. And so we, on which was a newspaper publisher. He came in to do a report. Then an investigation took place, and we got rid of the superintendent. Okay, for which we received the Mental Health Bell Award from the state, one of the highlights of my life.
So they awarded you after ignoring you.
Well, the state Mental Health Association did after they ignored us and the investigation took place and validated everything that we were saying. We were documenting everything.
Okay.
And so, but after that, I couldn't get a job because I was a whistleblower.
You
know what happens with Lisa. I couldn't get a job, so I wanted to leave the hospital at that time. They wanted us to stay and rebuild and all of that crap. So I called my friend Marty Rossmarin, who I'd interned with. He was at the Clifford Beers clinic, and I told him my story. He contacted his director, who contacted a woman named Gloria Schaefer, who was a state rep. She got me some grant money, so I was able to leave the hospital and still be able to earn a living. And so I did that for about 1 or 2 years. And then I went to the prison so that I could work with narcotic residents in a therapeutic community. So that is part of my transition. And my prison work was very exciting, which if you want to know about, I'll be happy to tell you.
Absolutely. Unless Tom has any questions, I want to know about the prison work.
Let's go with that first. Yes.
Okay. So I go to the prison because I wanted to work in a therapeutic community. A therapeutic community was really developed in England by a guy named Maxwell Jones, who worked in a collaborative way with patients in a community-based or in a home where everybody was open to discussion. So I wanted that experience. Nothing was happening in Connecticut except in the prison. There was a therapeutic community. I had never worked with narcotic addicts except a little bit at the hospital. I never worked in a therapeutic community. I went into the hospital. I went into the prison as a director of one of the units, and I was in a totally new environment that blew my mind, okay? I was scared. My first day, it's like amazing. My first day, I was sitting in a group because the groups were ongoing. I was in like 15 groups a day, a week when I was working there. But this is my first day. I'd introduced myself to the staff, and they asked me all sorts of questions about why I'm working in prisons, etc. I told them the same story I'm telling you. And then I went into a group. So I'm sitting in a group, and I was used to doing groups a certain way at the hospital. So I'm listening to the interaction of the residents in the therapeutic community, all hardcore narcotic addicts, heroin addicts. And I ask a question to one of the inmates, at which point a young narcotic addict kid raises his hand and says, and the leader, in a therapeutic community, anybody could be a leader. Could be a resident, could be a staff member, could be me. So the leader says, let's call him Raphael. I don't want to say his name. But Raphael, what have you got to say? You're raising your hand. He says, I got some feelings about Steinfeld, which was me. This is my first day in the group. At which point, the guy says, well, get your feelings off. He starts yelling at me for about an hour. About how stupid I was, that I was killing the resident. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I was so, it took me 6 months of nightmares. I would wake up with nightmares because I couldn't understand this approach. It was new to me. It took me 6 months to finally catch on to what was going on in this therapeutic community. Once I caught on and understood what they were trying to do, it was a great experience. I worked there for 5.5 years. I got involved during my work at the prison. I got involved in transactional analysis, which was another treatment approach. And I got involved with the spiritual approach, which I was introduced to by an inmate, one of the residents. Great story. You want to hear the story about how I got involved with Ram Dass, etc.?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Ram Dass is he's a legend, right?
He's a legend, right? So I'm doing my work in the therapeutic community, doing whatever I know, learning whatever I can about the guys, etc. And this guy, Joe, who I've been trying to locate for 40 years now because I love him, he says, hey, Doc, they're taking us out down to Danbury. Taking us out at his sort of, they're able to take us out to go to a meeting. I said, well, what's the meeting about, Joe? He said, well, this guy, Swami Satchidananda, right, is coming to give a talk. He's a yogi. At which point I said, who the fuck is Swami Satchidananda? I never heard of him, etc. I said, Joe, of course, everybody in prisons are paranoid. So I said, Joe, are you trying to get out of something upstairs? Are you trying to get out of something?
He might have been trying to get out of some work.
Yeah, he was trying to get. I thought
a day off.
Because I was paranoid just like everybody else. I didn't trust anybody of these guys. So he said, and he just looked me in the eye and said, Doc, I'm telling you, you're going to enjoy this. So my wife and I went down. And we had an evening with Swami Satchidananda. He's a beautiful guy, just came from India, who started the Integral Yoga Institute in Danbury, and it became a national Yoga Institute. I don't know if you know Swami Satchin, a beautiful person.
I know about Integral Yoga.
Integral Yoga.
Sri Aurobindo did Integral Yoga work.
Yes. Well, he may have been a follower of Aurobindo because he was just a beautiful guy.
Yeah, and the mother.
And so a month later, he says, hey, Doc, you know, I've been corresponding with a guy named Paul Rollins. I said, who's Paul Rollins? He says, well, he wants to come in and lead us in a yoga group. I said, wow, that's great. Let me meet with Paul. So I met with Paul. Paul was a TWA pilot who had dropped out in the 60s. He was living in Danbury, but he was going into New York as a student of Ram Dass. Mm-hmm. And Ram Dass had a prison ashram project. He would send people in to prisons to see if he could transform prisons into ashrams, okay? To make them paranoid systems into peaceful and compassionate systems. So he had about 500 prisons that he was working with. And Paul was a student of his, and a meditation student.
Okay.
And so I met with Paul. I liked him right away. I went to my associate warden. I said, Max, we want to start a yoga group. How do you feel about that? Because you have to, you know, pass through everything with the, in a prison. He said, okay, Steinfeld, but I want you to be there because they're going to bring in contraband and you have to be very careful about that. I said, thank you very much, Max. Okay. So for the next 2 or 3 years, we ran a yoga group in the prison. And so inmates would come, you know, some of our in our program, but others of the 2,000 other inmates that were in the prison at that time. And we were trained in yoga postures, meditation, breathing exercises. And I remember Paul brought in, he's a wonderful person. He also turned me on to a mushroom later on in my life, but that's another story.
Whee!
So he brought in a woman called Soma Krishna to lead us in a meditation, also a New York student of Ram Dass.
Okay.
And she said to us, I'll never forget this because it's stuck in, ever since I've been meditating, now this was in 1975, okay? No one was doing meditation and yoga at that time. Well, very few people were. And she said, ever since I've been meditating, I haven't been anxious, depressed, or angry. I said, holy shit. I said, this is the world that I work in. I'm going to study this. So ever since then, I got all of Ram Dass tapes. Everything I can get my hands on, I went to his workshops around New York State and in Connecticut, and I've been following Ram Dass, who, with whom I had a Skype meeting about a month ago. Okay.
Okay.
It was a beautiful session. I just thanked him for everything. I said, "You saved my life, Ram Dass." You know, it was a beautiful Skype talk, and so that was part of my transformation. Into the spiritual realm from psychotherapy, psychoanalytic psychotherapy, behavior therapy, cognitive behavior therapy, transactional analysis, and then Buddhist. I'm really interested in Buddhist more than Hindu work. Mm-hmm. So that got me interested in the Eastern traditions. That's essentially where I still am now.
That's a multiple level paradigm shifts you got going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, I would never have thought that I would be interested in any of this when I started out. No, it's true, you know. And then I've come a little further, which I'll be happy to share with you down the line after you ask me whatever you want to ask me.
Now, during your initial training, how would you how would you look at it and compare it to what happened subsequently?
My initial training has about 5% of what I do now.
Okay.
In other words, psychoanalysis, although psychoanalysis, and with all due respects, has really changed, but there's no evidence for the effectiveness. I'm trained as a scientist practitioner. I'm interested in raising questions about what's effective and what's not in helping people to reduce their suffering. Right. Psychoanalysis, I know people who have been in analysis for 50 years. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. That's crazy. It's so exploitative, and patients or clients don't know anything else. They don't know the questions to ask. They don't know why they're even in therapy other than the fact that they're suffering. You go to an analyst, back then at least, you would go three, four, five times a week. And I was in therapy with an analyst when I started my graduate training at Yeshiva University in 1961. I said, I'm so screwed up that I better enter therapy. I was in therapy twice a week for 3 years until I went on internship in 1964. My therapist may have said to me three or four things in the 3 years I was with him.
Wow. So just it's just a session that you could just go and talk.
You could
have done that in a recorder.
Yes. But no, it was nice. I'll tell you, I really cared about him. I wanted to please him. I was, you know, in that state where I wanted his approval, you know. And I would talk openly about everything that was going on. My father died soon after I entered graduate school. He was there for me. You know, he said a wonderful thing to me when I was weeping and grieving and crying, and I would come in and sit down and just cry about my father's death. And one day he said to me, after I was doing this, I mean, I would just do that. I don't even know how I got through the first year of graduate school because of my father's death. But as I was really weeping one day, he said to me a very interesting thing. It was very important, actually. He said to me, I almost feel what you're going through. He did not say, I feel what you're going through.
No.
Right? Because he could never feel what I'm going through. But he was really letting me know that he was really doing his best to hear my pain. So that was very important to me. He said a few other things. Another thing I remember him saying, I was complaining about my mother still at that time because I was into analysis, and everybody in analysis complains about their mother. You know, so
the root of all of our problems.
The root of all of our problems. And so I was complaining about her. And he just said, you know, your mother had four men to take care of. I said, what? My mother had four men to take care of? Which, of course, was true. My father and three sons. Yep. I never thought of it that way. It was only supposed to be me, right? I was so egocentric, right, at that time that, you know, if she wasn't focusing her whole life around me, I was fucked up, right?
Right.
So that was a good shift in perspective. And I'm writing a book now called Shifting Perspective, which is really a cognitive spiritual orient. When you shift a viewpoint, you shift a perception of reality, it has a profound effect on how you feel and what you do. And so that work on shifting perspective came out of early work that I did at the university, and I published a paper on that. And then I came back to it later and wrote a paper called Is there an empirical foundation for a spiritual psychotherapy? I wrote that Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy, in which I pulled together, that was about 10 years ago, I pulled together all of my thoughts about psychology and how it could become a spiritual quest.
Okay,
so that's essentially where I've been the last.
Now, George, I have a kind of a unusual question here. Now, during your training in the university, and maybe subsequently after in your early works, how much time was it spent that when you saw a client, right? Mm-hmm. And not knowing what this individual had gone through,
right?
Physically, you know, when somebody, you know, is called a schizophrenic, schizophrenia could you know, could be a simple situation that can be overcome with time, but it could very well also be a physical problem with a chemical imbalance or some sort of, you know, a head injury or something.
Right.
How much time is actually spent in identifying those kind of problems that may exist or pre-exist with this individual?
A very good question. So we would do all of that exploration, okay, with the clients because we were into analysis and wanted to know as much as we can about their history, okay? Now, a fascinating thing, which also is a very turning point in my life. I had tried everything. She'd been on a lot of different medications, right? So, you know, you go into a mental hospital, that's all they do is put you on medication and turns you into a little zombie. That's one of the things we argued against, okay? Because when you turn a patient into a zombie, they have no voice, right? They can't articulate their feelings and thoughts. They define themselves as sick people, they define themselves by their label, you see. That's why Zaz's work, The Myth of Mental Illness, is such a profound work, to me anyway, not to other people in our field, because they keep on writing DSM-3s and 4s, and now a 5 is coming out, where they diagnose people, and then they treat them a lot with medication, okay? After they've created a problem, and then they treat them with medication, okay? It's a crazy system. The whole mental health field is a crazy system. So, of course, we explored her whole history. And so I tried everything I could possibly do with this young lady. I had read everything in the field of psychotherapy. People like Harold Searles, who worked with schizophrenics. Mm-hmm. Frieda Fromm Reichman, who dealt with schizophrenics. A book was written, I can't promise you a rose garden. I never promised you a rose garden based on this work. And so I read everything. And I also even read a person by the name of Rosen, who did direct psychoanalytic psychotherapy, where you challenge the belief system of the patient. So one day I come in to see Joanne. I've tried everything. Nothing is working, right? And I decide to try direct psychoanalytic psychotherapy. I almost drove her crazy. She got so scared of me that she refused to see me for months. Three times a week, I would go to the back wards where she was. I would say to the nurses, I'm here to see Joanne. I would sit in the room. She would never show up. Three times a week, I did that for months, okay? Please tell Joanne I'm sorry if I upset her. I would like very much to talk to her, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, she came back. Of course, I apologized for upsetting her. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was trying everything I could, okay? But I said to her, Joanne, you're like a rock. I'm not forgetting this. You're like a rock. You hold on to your beliefs with intensity. And she looked at me, at least in my memory, this is what she said, that's the only thing I have. That was a profound moment.
It's an identity thing.
Identity thing, yeah. Exactly. Okay. If she let go of who she thought she was, she would lose her identity, and that is so anxiety-producing that she couldn't handle that, okay? And that's one of my still beliefs now. There are core beliefs out of cognitive therapy, which I then studied with Albert Ellis. You know Albert Ellis at the Institute for Rational Therapy? He's one of the leading cognitive therapists. He was the first cognitive therapist, and then I studied with him in the 70s.
Okay.
And the cognitive therapy is about what you believe, okay?
Right.
And if you have core beliefs to which you are attached, you know, using the Buddhist word attachment.
Right.
If you're attached to that belief system, that is who you are. It is extremely difficult for a person to let go of those beliefs because they would feel like they will disintegrate as a being. So you have to chip away at their cognitive distortions a little bit at a time, okay, to help them shift to realize they are not who they think they are.
Right.
Ram Dass, who they
program themselves to be.
Exactly.
Outside forces have programmed them to be.
That's right. So they have a belief about, this is who I am. I'm a schizophrenic. I'm manic depressive. I'm an anxiety. I'm full of anxiety. I'll never get over my anxiety. I'm a depressed person. I'm an angry person. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. Okay?
And the more they talk about it, the more it's reinforced.
The more it's reinforced.
Exactly. The more the pathways in the brain are dug in deeper.
Exactly. Exactly. So my job is to say, wait a second, do you think we can take a look at that and maybe who you think you are is not who you are? Maybe there's more to you than just the label, okay? And that's what I try to do. The other thing, with my clients, the other thing I learned at the prison was that there was very little difference. If you peeled away the fact that they were dope fiends and drug addicts and all of that, there was very little difference on a human level between them and me.
Right. Okay?
And so I wrote a paper, again, back then, called Dope Fiend Irrationality. It Takes One to Know One. Because I was identifying with the irrational beliefs that these guys were carrying around. They were totally false. They had defined themselves as dope fiends, okay? And I saw much more to them than the fact that they happened to learn how to take dope when they were under stress, or they learned that in their communities. You know, I dealt with people in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, New York City, you know, the hotbed of all of those communities, which a lot of drugs, and they never questioned this, okay? So my job was to help them start to question who they thought they were. There's more to you, you know.
There's
Jamil,
more to you, yeah.
Than the fact that you're a dope fiend, which right. you are, of course.
But you are, yeah. I'm not. You're not like saying they're not. You are, yeah. But there's more to you than that. Okay,
more.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right
okay.
back.
Okay.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products, ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health, and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
And we're back.
Okay.
So, George, when they were under the influence, did you find that any particular time that based on either a chemical problem or something within their brain that may have changed their behavior?
I'm not trained in medication. I don't know how medications work. I'm not sure that psychiatrists know how medications work. Now, if you're going to ask me, I was so against medication, okay, because of what I saw at the prison, at the hospital, where people were over-medicated and turned into what I said were zombies, okay, who couldn't even question anything, really, or challenge the system or say, wait, you know. So I was so against medication that I made a mistake with my own daughter. My daughter, clearly early, had a learning disability. She was not perceiving the world in ways that were useful for her. She had fine motor problems, gross motor problems. My wife, who went to school to become a learning disability teacher back then, when she was a kid, that was over 40 years ago, actually diagnosed my daughter with that problem. And then we got help for her, and she eventually got through grammar school and high school. She went to college, et cetera.
Is it one of the things going on now, the ADD or Asperger's? Or
right, yeah. Well, she wasn't Asperger's, but she had to learn. She wasn't perceiving the world in appropriate ways. Her head was always tilted. You know, her vision seemed to be off. Her fine motor core was off, okay? But, you know, with the help that we gave her, and really my wife mainly, she eventually got through college, you know, and became a recruiter and all of that. So, but during the period when she was suffering, again, as I was so against medication that I made a mistake. I should have said, Brenda, I think a little bit of Ritalin, just a little bit. I was so scared of medication.
Right.
That a little bit of Ritalin may have helped you focus a little bit better, because she's totally disorganized, right? Even today, she had an organizational problem. So I made a mistake with that. So now when I see patients or clients, as I said, I call them, and I feel that some medication would help calm them down, okay? Help them refocus so they can do psychotherapy, I recommend a judicious amount of medication from a psychiatrist that I know. But please take the minimal amount, start off very small, and then see if that helps you. Okay? So I've changed my position on that over the years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to give you a little story I have. Back when I was in my teenager, I had a friend. We were, you know, in school together. And when we finished high school, we went to the spring break down in Florida. Mm-hmm. At that particular time, the only thing I knew about him, let's say, in his private life, was that his parents had split up kind of recently, and he was living with his father. And his brother, a younger brother, was living with his mom. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, he never brought up. I mean, we're guys, you know. Guys don't talk much about anything. So, you know, I just thought he was a happy-go-lucky type of guy. He was, he was doing a lot of weights. You know, he was a very strong kid, you know. Mm-hmm. But very nice and quiet, you know, otherwise. Anyway, when we came back from Florida, we decided to go to a camp. Out near Detroit, and this was kind of an area where they had three campgrounds. One was like for the teenagers, one for families, and one for sort of couples and mix. Well, we couldn't get into the teenage ones because they were already full, so we ended up in the family campground. Again, there was about 8 or 9 of us, so we kind of split up and went in different ways to meet people and, you know, like what most young people do. Mm-hmm. And one point when we came back to the camp, he started acting really weird, you know, unusual for this type of individual. You know, he started acting like, you know, I'm God, you know, I want to, you know, jumping on top of cars and acting really, really bizarre. So I kind of asked the other guys that were with him, I said, did you guys do anything? You know, did you take any drugs, whatever?
Right.
Mm-hmm. They said, no, all they did was they met some girls and they passed, you know, one toke around, meaning that one puff each individual.
Right.
So I'm thinking now, you know, I'm young, I'm only like, you know, 17, 18 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, if they only did one puff, what could possibly go wrong in that? Right?
Well.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, he started to get worse and worse as time went on.
Yeah.
You know, he started reacting like very strange, and it's almost like he didn't know what his surroundings were at the time. You know, he was being God, he was big, he was powerful, he was all this and that, you know, real delusional type stuff. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I went off for, I don't know, maybe about 20 minutes. The next thing I hear is police cars coming over.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get called back. The police says we have to leave the place. Mm-hmm. So he's still jumping around on top of the car, ripping his clothes off, you know, still calling himself God, whatever. And all this behavior, you know, we don't have no clue
right.
why this has happened, right?
Yeah.
So we get in the car. I tell a couple of my friends, I said, make sure you hold him down because, like, he was acting really bizarre. Like, he wanted to, like, you know, almost hit you or do something, right?
Yeah, he was having a psychotic episode, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I was, like, scared and I was going to be the driver, right? So I just booted it back. But we get about 20 minutes from home, which is about an hour or so later, an hour and a half. And all of a sudden, he says to me, hey, what are we doing down here?
Wow.
Right?
Interesting story.
And I said, what do you mean, what are we doing down here?
Yeah.
Didn't you know what you did over there?
You're God. You should know these things.
Yes, right.
He goes, what are you talking about? It was like you know, like a light flicked out or flicked in, you know?
Right.
And like nothing happened. He did not remember one single iota of what he had done. So I bring him back to his father's place, and I said to him, you know, I'm going to hang around here, and I explained to him what had happened. Mm-hmm. And his father said, I have no clue. He's never had this kind of problem before.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so then we went on for a few months, and then he met a girl a few months later. And again, she must have gave him, again, you know, a couple of puffs
hits, right?
of something. And same behavior again.
Right, yes.
And this time, you know, he went way out of his way. he went out and he made a nuisance of himself. He took his clothes off and the police, you know, charged him and so on and so forth.
So
to make this long story short, he ended up being charged numerous times by the police. Every time he would take a puff, never mind taking, like, you know, an extensive amount of anything. He got charged by the police numerous times. They took him to, you know, mental hospital, which, of course, was the wrong thing to do because he wasn't a mental problem that he was having, right? And nobody identified that when he was doing a drug, the chemical reaction that was already in his brain was affecting it in such a way to cause him the psychotic behavior.
I believe that.
And eventually, he ended up in a criminal-type mental hospital, which within a week, they claimed that he committed suicide.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tragic story because no one asked the right questions, right?
That was...
No one asked the right question.
And I find with most psychiatrists that I, you know, I've worked with many, they miss the physical problems that may be there, but they may be in a very small small way.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's a very interesting story, irrelevant to a family that I'm seeing now who has now a 29-year-old daughter who's totally paranoid. And I believe that her paranoia and her mental disturbance at this point was probably precipitated by some drugs that she took at Sarah Lawrence College and continued even after she graduated. And I think it was fed by her brother, who would give her pot.
Right.
So we have a paranoid young lady, scared, you know, and thinking that all her friends hate her, et cetera, and her brother gives her pot on top of that. And so I clearly told the family that you better get your son, clearly out of the picture because he's feeding, because I don't think her brain can, she is so vulnerable right now that anything you do to her brain is going to make it worse. Yeah, and I do think that happens with a lot of people. Yes.
Well, yeah, like I found that people that may have a predisposition already, like that you may not see it obviously, you know, in their behavior. You know, like for instance, in this kid's case, when the parents had split up, he felt it and he carried it, even though he didn't show it to us. You know, we were just his friends, and at the time, you know, what do we know?
Right.
But obviously that was affecting enough that when you introduced a drug into the mix, you know, that just pushed it over the limit.
It's true. One of the people that I read early in my, another person that I read who another influence about in terms of drugs was a research psychiatrist named John Lilly. Did you ever hear of John Lilly's work?
No.
Center of the Cyclone.
What I, John Lilly, I have. I've read it, yeah.
You've read it. So right, he isolated himself in an isolation tank, right, and took LSD to explore his mind. Well, what he discovered, the essence of his book, from at least from my point of view, was whatever you believe to be true is true, or you make it become true. Okay? And so the mind, okay, the mind creates belief systems, and then you act in accord with that belief system, and then you find that you you create the world which validates your belief system. We all, my position is we all do that, not to the extent that Lilly did it with ketamine and LSD and other things that he ingested, but we all have these basic belief systems which we then act in accord with, and then we prove to ourselves that we're right. Okay?
Of course.
The movie, the movie Altered States, loosely was based on that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, we do that every day anyways, because
we all do it.
We whatever we have in our subconscious mind, whether it's our you know, we're a smoker, we're a drinker, we're whatever, you know, that's part of the habit problems that we all have.
Yes.
And we all carry them to some degree.
Right.
Now, if we were able to tap into the subconscious mind anytime we wanted to and, and able to take them out, then we wouldn't be in the kind of mess that we're in most of the time.
Well, that's an interesting segue into the emotional freedom techniques, okay, and behavioral kinesiology that some of us use to tap in to those belief systems, okay? So I don't use, you know, behavioral kinesiologists use the arm. Did you see them work with the arm response?
Yep.
Yep.
Right, so I don't do that because I want to get myself out of the picture, and I know I could never trust myself that there would be a differential pressure on the arm. Right, so I was taught a procedure by Tappas Fleming, who's an acupuncturist and an energy healer, in which you use the head response. In other words, when I talk to a person and I get the sense that there's some resistance to getting over the problem, which now I think is the biggest problem in psychotherapy, the fact that patients don't do everything they can do in order to change. They resist changing, and Freud knew about that, not taking that away from him. But what he would do, he would analyze the resistance, which would take years and years and years. Whereas Roger Callahan, who developed these energy procedures, discovered that if you tap on your karate chop part while you make a particular statement, that frequently gets over your resistance, or what he calls reversals. So what happens now, I just wrote a big paper on that, on resistance. And so if I get the sense that people aren't doing the work in psychotherapy that they need to do, I give them a list of about 100 questions. Okay? I want to get over the problem. I ask them to make the statement and allow their head to go yes or no. Right? So I want to get over this problem. Yes, head response. It'll be good for me to get over this problem. Yes. I deserve to get over this problem. Very frequently, I get a no response. People have a very difficult time feeling that they deserve health and happiness. A friend of mine who's into energy work, who is an energy healer. He gives workshops all over the country. And he asked the audience, how many of you want to be healthy and happy? Everybody raises their hand. Then he says, how many of you believe that you will be healthy and happy? He says 50 to 90% don't raise their hand. So there's a belief system that we're carrying around on your subconscious level that either we don't deserve to be healthy and happy, or we won't be able to be healthy and happy, or we're afraid to be healthy and happy, or something bad will happen,
or something, or the world won't allow us, or the universe.
But that's because permit. That's because we get trained that way, though, from a child, right? So how do you know if you were to take a child right now, right, of let's say 4, 5, 6 years old, when they're just starting, you know, some sort of schooling, and you start teaching them how to control, how to meditate, and how to control their subconscious. Mm-hmm. Would we be having these problems later on when we get older? Well, of course not.
I think you're correct. And I would love every school system to start to teach kids how to sit there and quietly observe their mind and meditate and try to understand that their thoughts are just thoughts, okay? They don't have to believe it. In fact, in my office, I have two sayings. One is, don't believe everything you think. That's one saying. The other is, let go or be dragged. That's an AA a little message. Because we hold on to all sorts of painful things and painful beliefs, okay? And as long as we hold on to them rather than letting them go through forgiveness, through acceptance, through taking a moral inventory that AA suggests, we can't let go of some of the painful beliefs that cause us painful emotions.
Of course.
And, you know, so that's where I am now with the emotional freedom techniques.
That's very interesting. It's funny that people would, they're built by their surroundings and they're built by their environment. I think there was a scientist, I can't remember the name of the video, but there was a scientist who was talking about having cells in three petri dishes, and depending upon what solution or what he put in the petri dish, they could form skin cells, or it could form bone, or it could form
Bruce Lipton, Biology of Belief.
Absolutely brilliant stuff. He was coming out with the environment basically has that effect. And we have the environment around us with the political systems and religious systems and identification and our guidelines for life and our moral outlook. Jacques Fresco said something that I found was very interesting. He said, if you said there were some missionaries that went to deep in the jungle and they were talking to the headhunters there, and one of the missionaries said to the headhunter, he said, don't you feel bad that you've got 4 shrunken heads on your belt? And the headhunter said, of course I feel bad. My brother has 20.
You're right. Right. That's right. Yes. So this is where I am in my work. I combine transactional analysis with cognitive behavior therapy and energy work. With family therapy, I was trained at the Mental Research Institute, where this guy Haley, who I mentioned earlier, originally trained, was on the staff. And so I'm a supervisor in family therapy now, because I know the system. I know the environment affects the belief system of their children. Okay,
right.
And so I'm interested in that. Yes.
Well, I mean, I find in my practice, and you know, most of my clients, when they come in with a problem. Usually, there's many, many, you know, other problems that don't come out right in the beginning, then come out, you know, much later. And you know, finding the core problem that may have caused whatever the effect that they have now, you know, can predate, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 years.
Well, that's an interesting problem in our field, because most of us do not work with contracts. Now, a contract is, what is it that you're here for? What is it that you want to change about your life? Okay. Now, even though I think you're correct, that even though a person might say, this is what I want to alter, my thoughts, my feelings, my actions, it may be that as they do that, other things open up, which then requires a redefinition of your contract. So we originally said you wanted to get over your fear of heights. Fine. We've done that. Now, is there anything else you want to that concerns you? Or we'll terminate our therapy right then, okay? And usually there are other things that people want to work on, but they didn't define when they came in. But that's a contractual thing. That's the ethical basis. That's the basis of what I consider an ethical practice of psychotherapy, and that is to do effective work as efficiently as you possibly can. And as Eric Byrne said many years ago, if you can cure a patient in one session, that's what you should do.
Of course.
And then if you don't cure them in one session, you should spend the rest of your week figuring out how to do it in the next session. Yep. So that's a sort of motto for me, to work effectively and efficiently, because that's the ethical way to work.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you now, and I'm not sure if this is an area that, you know, of expertise, but people that have had experience in the UFO-type realities, whether they've seen things or they had experiences with the abduction phenomenon and such, have you come across much of that in your practice?
No, I have not. You know, my nephew, who, you know, Scott talked to me about, and maybe you did too, you know, Alan has been into UFO, you know, things for people who come to me don't mention UFOs. Now, I don't know why. Maybe because I haven't had the good fortune of meeting those people who do believe in UFOs, but that has never been in my 46 years a concern that I can remember someone bringing in.
But I mean, I'm not necessarily talking UFOs, but I mean any other unusual. I mean, most of the time psychiatrists will always call it schizophrenia, but you know, people that have had some kind of strange, you know, seeing strange things or feeling
paranormal experience, you know, possession,
whatever you want. Put it as.
I don't generally see psychotic people. They don't generally call me up and say, I want to come in. Now, it may be that they are psychotic after the hand. We discover that afterwards. But I don't see people who come in and say, this family that I see, they have this psychotic daughter who's hears and voices, etc. But she refuses to come in. I said, Liz, why don't you? I asked her once when she came in with the family, I'd love to talk to you more about your experiences, but she doesn't want psychotherapy. She wants to go for her medication, okay? And that's what she does. She gets medicated by a psychiatrist, and it's driving the parents crazy. So I work with the parents about how to deal with this kid of theirs who seems not to want to get healthy. Mm-hmm. What are they supposed to do about that?
In a sense of perception, though, if a person were to come to you and said, you know, I've had, you know, this weird experience in the middle of the night where I saw, you know, these little bug-eyed little guys, how would you consider that?
That's interesting. So why are you coming to me about that? I would say, what is it that you want from me that you're telling me about that? Okay.
Well, let's say I'm going to say to you that I need help.
Yeah,
and you're a psychiatrist. You got to help me out.
Well, I'm a psychologist. Help you out how? I mean, so you have these experiences with UFOs. So what's your problem? I don't know what your problem is. So if you have these experiences, huh?
Fear.
Oh, you're afraid. Oh, yeah. What specifically are you afraid of?
These individuals.
What are you afraid? What is there about them that you're afraid of? What about these individuals
that scares
you?
I'm afraid they may kill me, they may injure me, they may...
Okay. Now, do you want to get over that fear?
Yes.
Okay. We can get over the fear by desensitization so that you can have experiences with these people without being afraid. Now, you can't do anything about these people appearing to you, but you can get over your fear of these people. Now, if you want to get over your fear, I'll be happy to help you. But I can't do anything about these people appearing to you.
Okay.
Okay, so that would be my essential position. Your fear, I could handle, right? What happens to you, okay, what experiences you have, I have no control over that. I have no influence over that. Do you want to get rid of those? If you want to get rid of those perceptions, I don't know how to do that for you. Because I don't know if they're real or not.
And here Tom was thinking that he could come to you and you're an alien buster. Like a Ghostbuster only with aliens.
That's how sometimes we're perceived, right?
Yeah, right. That's true.
Well, Tom's worked on about 100 abduction cases.
Fascinating.
Well, they come to him because he holds his hand up and goes, "Hey, I look after abduction people," and then they swarm on him.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I over the years, I've worked with a number of psychologists and psychiatrists that have taken up those type of situations.
Even
though it's a subject that's kind of, off the cuff and to the side, psychiatry has sort of kind of like pushed it off and hasn't really looked at it.
No, I would be interested in hearing all of these people's experiences, I really would. I mean, I'm open to it, but so if you want to tell me about your experiences with these aliens, I'd be fascinated to hear it. But I don't know what I can do. What is it that you want me to do to help you with that? That's a different kind of question. I have met with cult members. Cults are a very fascinating group. I'm seeing two people now who have been a member of a cult. One was born into the cult. The other joined it later on. They both eventually left and married, okay? But they're still suffering the remnants of being in a cult, which was, a programmed way of seeing reality. Okay.
Yeah. Was it called Christianity?
No.
Okay.
Actually, it was called ethical realism, and at first blush, it had a lot to offer. But when I went to an ashram once, this is my basic thing about. I went up to Kripalu Institute, which is a yoga institute, and the yogi was there, Yoga Desai, his name was, and there was satsang, and people were, dancing and waving their hands, and then there was a question and answer period. And one of the questions had to do with being able to voice your opinion, which is different than the gurus. And I forget how it was phrased, but as soon as I heard the guru's response, I knew the guy was a phony, you see? Because he would never allow people to challenge anything he was talking about, okay? So they became dependent on him for their reality. Whereas in Ram Dass, you see, why I loved Ram Dass so much is when he was a teacher, okay, when he started to feel that people were getting too dependent on him, he would disband the meditation group because he knew something not healthy was happening. People were giving up their lives to other person other than finding their own guru in their own heart. And that's why I loved Ram Dass from the very beginning.
You are your own guru.
You are your own guru. If you meet the guru on the road, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Remember that?
Yeah.
Remember that book?
Exactly.
Well, that's the essence of that book, right?
Just a reflection back on what we were talking about earlier as far as abduction cases and psychiatry. Professor John Mack, who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard, basically when he got into it, he got a lot of backlash from, backlash from the community he was involved in. But, I mean, being who he was, such a well-known figure, I mean, Harvard, professor, they couldn't keep him down. I mean, he did a lot of work in the field of alien abductions and talking to people and listening to what they had to say. It goes a long way.
Right, right. Yes, because he wasn't afraid to lose his job.
No, exactly. I guess not.
But one thing I found, though, with as well as this or any other type of case, and I'm not talking just in the UFO paranormal type scenario. When we're dealing with belief systems, right, that are already ingrained into our, the back of our mind, it doesn't matter whether, you believe in a religion, you believe in UFOs, right. You believe in little aliens or whatever it may be, you're still dealing with belief systems, right? And you have to be able to challenge, those type of belief systems and be able to tap into it and see where they came from.
Right.
And how to deal with them and, possibly take them out, from wherever they happen to be. So if the fear, now even though, like what I found is that even though a lot of these folks were fearful of those, the aliens and whatever was going on, they still had some kind of attachment to them, that they felt they had to be part of them. They would come to me and say, I'm really scared, I'm afraid, I want to get rid of it. And as soon as I was saying to them, okay, if I were to give you a way to get out of it, would you take it? And they would say, well, I don't know.
Well,
maybe.
That's very interesting. That's a very interesting thing because in the 50s, Eric Fromm wrote a book called Escape from Freedom. And there are people in my field, very few, who think that all mental illness, are ways of avoiding responsibility for your own life.
So, and many other things.
So that what would happen to me if I gave up this belief in aliens or if I gave up the belief that my father molested me? Okay, because when you deal with trauma, someone comes in and finally acknowledges that their father or brother or someone sexually molested them. As a therapist, we don't know whether or not that's true. There is a whole controversy in our field on false memory syndrome. As a matter of fact, my wife and I wrote a play about the false memory syndrome, about the woman who was induced to believe that her father molested her. Okay, and then she killed herself, and there's a whole play on that. Because there are some researchers that say there is no such thing as a false memory, and other clinicians think that there is. Okay? And so, but if a person comes in and says, I have this memory that my father came into the room and touched me, okay, so what is it that you want me to do with that? Do you want to talk about that? Do you want to understand that? Do you want us to understand how that has affected you all your life? Do you want to get over that trauma? Okay? You tell me what you want now that you have that memory, what you want to do about it.
Well, you see, this is the whole thing, because I find that, psychiatry tends to worry about things that are not the solution. they're looking at, the overall situation. So if somebody comes to you and says, like you said, I had a problem with my father, you're just looking at that now and thinking, well, was it real? Is it false? Mm-hmm. But rather than trying to figure out, what is it that this person wants?
Right. Yeah.
How do they have to deal with it when they're coming to you?
Right. Paul Simon, Paul Simon, the writer, the lyricist.
Yeah.
On the Graceland, this is one of my mottos, actually. On the Graceland album, which is a great album, I love the album, there's a song called Gumboots. Yeah. And Gumboots describes, Paul Simon is walking down the streets with his friend, and his friend is talking about what's happening to him, et cetera, et cetera. And Simon says, breakdowns come and breakdowns go. What you going to do about it is what I want to know.
Exactly.
Well, that's been a mantra of mine. What do you want to do about it? What do you want to change about that? What is there about that's uncomfortable for you? So that's basically my position right now. What do you want to do about it?
You ever ask him, what are you getting out of it?
Well, that's right. What are you getting out of it? What are the pros and cons of... Actually, Byron Katie asked that question. She's a recovering alcoholic who has written Loving What Is and a number of other books. She has a series of questions that she asks people. Is it true? Are you absolutely sure that it's true? who would you be without that belief? Okay. Meaning, what are the advantages and disadvantages of holding on to that belief, right?
That's a big one. Who would you be without that belief?
Who would you be without that belief? You know, so she asked those kinds of questions, and people start to reflect on why they're holding on to this idea. What does it do for them?
Yeah, it's funny. I did a little experiment at work when I was just randomly going around, and I'd meet people. I do location work in the film industry. And I would meet people, and I would just say, after getting into a conversation, I'd say to them, what would you do if there was no money in the world and you could do anything you wanted? Mm-hmm. And what I found more often than not is it stopped them in their tracks and made them confused.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't shake their identity with their job.
With their job, right.
They couldn't mm-hmm. shake who they were. Mm-hmm. You could do anything you want. There's no money in the world. Doesn't exist. Everything's at your beck and call. You have free. You're free to do anything you want to do. What would you do? And they go, the big response I got was, I don't know.
Right. Well, you know, most people don't do what's in their heart to do. If you can find, you know, work that you do that's in your heart, then you're really one of the few lucky ones.
I mean, the easy flippant answer is, well, I'd be on a beach drinking margaritas, having naked village girls deliver, right. You know. I mean, that's, and some people, that may be what they would do.
Yeah, maybe they would do that.
Sure. But, I mean, as far as, you know, what would they really do? You know, you had some people that would latch onto it pretty much right away and go, wow, I've always wanted to write. No, or I've always wanted to do this or that, or I'd spend more time, you know, with my hobbies, because hobbies they do because not because they're being paid to do it, but because they love to do it.
They love it, right. Then it becomes a labor of love, and that's Ram Dass's question. Who are you after you finish being who you think you are?
Right, exactly.
That's his question. Oh, I'm getting a little tired, fellas.
Okay.
I'm an old man, you know.
Well, it's been an amazing interview, and I really... thank you for your time and your insight.
Thank you. I mean, you know, if you down the road you want to do some more of this, I enjoyed it. I love talking about my work and my experiences, because they've shaped me into who I am, you know, and who I think I am at this point anyway.
Who you're identified with.
And who I identified with, right. Well, thank you guys, you know, Scott and Tom, I appreciate, you know, your interest, and, you know, could I hear this interview at some point down the line?
Definitely.
Oh, definitely.
How do I do that?
You're just going to go to the past shows section, and under your picture and your biography, there'll be a MP3 player.
Okay.
And you'll be able to click on that and listen to it. But what we're going to do now is I'm just going to ask you quickly, do you have a website that people could go to?
Well, I don't know if I ever kept it up to date, but it might be www.drgeorgesteinfeld. I think I once made up a website like that, but I don't.
I think Tom's been there. When you do publish your book, maybe we can get a link to your website where people can go and purchase it.
Well, I've been writing the book for 20-odd years. I have this irrational fear. Maybe it's irrational, maybe not. If I ever finished the book, I would die. So that's
so you've decided to write the book forever.
That's a belief system I have, which I don't want to test out. So I keep writing it and expanding it. It's now 400 pages of stuff that I've...
That's hilarious.
Okay.
Wow. Thanks for your time, George.
All right, guys. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.